we're going to start on page 129 with spermatogenesis and oogenesis. In order to understand spermatogenesis and oogenesis, I'd like to give you some background information first. All right, so I know you probably had, say, high school biology at some point, and they maybe talked about mitosis and meiosis in there. Bio210, I know you guys talk about mitosis in that lab. So this is going to kind of pull some of your mitosis knowledge, and then we need to add meiosis or meiosis to the discussion as well. So there's some background terminology, and I need to make sure that I cover with you first. So in order to understand some of these new terms, let's talk about DNA for just a moment. DNA, you may have heard, can be chromatin during a portion of the cell's life cycle. We describe that as an unraveled state. It's not very organized, and it looks kind of like unraveled yarn when it's appearing in the nucleus. So that's the time during interphase that we expect to see that unraveled chromatin. When the cell is getting ready to divide, it then organizes the DNA into what's called a chromosome. You can have a single-stranded chromosome, which has basically an airplane propeller look to it. It has an arm or chromatid on top and an arm or chromatid on the bottom. So I'm going to label those arms as chromatids. When cells undergo division, we are going to let one set of chromatids stay with the parent cell, and we're going to give away another set of chromatids to the daughter cell. That means that I need a copy of those chromatids. These two on top are called sister chromatids, as are the ones on the bottom. So far, so good with our terms? Okay. Homologous chromosome is going to come into play when we talk about sex cells and making reproductive cells. We have 23 pairs of chromosomes. Those 23 pairs of chromosomes get together with their partner. If you've got 23 pairs of shoes at home, each individual shoe counted makes a total of 46. So I'm not going to draw out all of them up here, but this might be set number one, and then you've got set number two. And we can just keep counting until we have 23 pairs of chromosomes all lined up with their buddies. Okay, so the goal here is during meiosis, we're going to let those pairs or partners get together. Because they are of the same type, they're going to be called homologous chromosomes. Homo is a prefix here meaning same. So pair number one partners up, pair number two partners up, all the way down to partner set number 23. 23rd pair happens to be our sex chromosomes. So either you have an XX for a female or an XY for a male. Okay. Some language that helps us understand what's happening during meiosis is to understand terms like diploid and haploid. Diploid means that we have two sets of chromosomes, just like I've got drawn up here for our homologous chromosomes. So in our bodies, we expect to have a diploid set or 46 total chromosomes in most of our body cells. You may also hear the term haploid. Hap kind of sounds like half. And in this case, we've got half the normal chromosome count. In other words, we have 23 chromosomes. So if we went to your closet, and if in fact you did have 23 pairs of shoes, if I took all of your left shoes with me, I now have a haploid set of your shoes. You have a haploid set of your shoes. We split them up, right? So you have a shoe, and I have a shoe. We each have half of your shoes. Makes sense, okay? If you keep all your shoes, you've got 23 pairs of shoes, you've got both the left and the right shoe, you have a diploid set of shoes, okay? So we're gonna use this language of having the diploid set, 46 total, versus half the set when we talk about these sex cells that we're gonna make. Okay. Anybody need the board? I'm going to pull down the screen. Questions so far? If you'd like to have this, I'll give you a moment to snap a picture or jot this down. These are the differences between mitosis and meiosis. So mitosis is what we're familiar with. We've done that in Bio210. That is the way we make new body cells. So pretty much every cell in your body is made from old stem cells, those precursor cells, by way of dividing in half. And what we get is a clone of the parent cell. So by doing this, we maintain the chromosome number from parent cell to daughter cell. The place for cell division is drastically different is in the gonads. The gonads are things like testes and ovaries, and it's their job to make these cells with half the chromosome count. So we have to undergo two separate cell divisions to reduce the chromosome numbers by half. We end up producing genetically different cells this way, and that's how you have siblings within the same family that may look similar, but have completely different DNA from each other. So this meiosis process is sex cell division only. This is how you make egg and sperm. Just checking to see if anybody still needs a screen. Mm-hmm. Anybody else still need it? Okay. gonna hit the lights for just a moment for you. I know this is tiny, but the gist is what we want to see inside those cells. And this is on the NOVA website, and they actually compare mitosis on the left to meiosis on the right. I think when we start this thing off, it looks pretty familiar. You're running through interphase, now prophase, and then we're going to watch specifically what happens during metaphase. On the left, you'll notice along the metaphase plate, this one on the left is mitosis. All 46 chromosomes line up single file across your metaphase plate. We pop them in half, and you have one set of sister chromatids going to one pole of the cell and the other set traveling to the opposite end. So we end up producing diploid cell daughter cells, which are identical to the parent cell. Now, take a look over here at meiosis. We're going to go through two division phases. Meiosis 1 has 46 chromosomes, but they're lined up with their homologous pair. So it's like taking the shoes that match and putting them together on that metaphase plate. And as we progress through metaphase to anaphase, you'll notice during meiosis, we actually separate those chromosomes from their homologous pair. So it's like taking your left shoe and your right shoe and giving them to two different cells, okay? So if you were mitosis, you'd be done at this point. That's cool narration for this. That's good. Everything is the same so far. Okay, and now we're back to metaphase. So keep in mind, meiosis is two division processes. During meiosis two, this time we have 23 chromosomes lined up on one metaphase plate and 23 chromosomes lined up on the other metaphase plate. Since we have 23 chromosomes in each cell, is each cell diploid or haploid? Haploid, yeah. And notice they've got two chromatids on top and two chromatids on the bottom. Are they single-stranded or double-stranded? Double, yeah. Like an X, looks like an X is double-stranded. Okay, so if it was single-stranded, it would be one arm on top and one arm or one leg on the bottom. Okay. All right, so as we divide through anaphase into telophase, what we've done now is we've made four total cells, and in each one of those nuclei, we have a single-stranded haploid set of chromosomes. We started with double-stranded, diploid, homologous chromosomes partnered up. So by going through this division process, we've actually separated this mass amount of DNA into four separate cells. So you wonder how, you know, siblings can look very similar, others may look very different, and it has to do with those chromatid arms that stick together. When they're laying nearby a neighbor, they may actually break an arm off and switch with their neighbor's chromosome. So you get a little genetic mixing as you go through this meiosis process. All right. So what I'd like to take you through now is spermatogenesis and oogenesis. And I'm going to draw you something like this on the board, or you can use what's on the very bottom of page 129. So I'm going to use some shorthand here. I'm going to start you off with a cell and a male testis that has 2N as a code. 2N indicates a diploid cell. Okay, 2N indicates diploid. So in male testes, around the time of puberty, stem cells called spermatogonia are going to initiate the process of making new sperm. So up until around, say, ages 11 to 14, these stem cells have been just sitting there and waiting. About the time of puberty, this is a great review for endocrine, gonadotropic releasing hormone, remember it, GnRH, comes from the brain. it travels to the anterior pituitary, releases LH and FSH. Those hormones travel to the testes and tell the testes not only to make testosterone, but also to increase sperm production. So that mechanism kicks on at the time of puberty. So that's how we've come full circle back to the endocrine. Once we start undergoing this process of making sperm, that spermatogonium will undergo mitosis. How many cells result from mitosis?
Two.
And I know it looks funny on your paper because we're only going to follow the pathway of one. Do you know what happened to the second one? Well, if you use up all your stem cells, you have none left. So what you end up doing is sending one of your two mitosis products back to the stem cell line to continue making sperm. So we're only going to follow the pathway of one of the results of mitosis. We'll just pick on this cell here. 2N means what?
Diploid.
Diploid, right. How many chromosomes does that primary spermatocyte carry? 46, good. These cells have double-stranded chromosomes, and I'm going to put a representative set there for us to watch. Okay, just a way of review here. Mitosis produces two cells that are identical to the parent cell. Meiosis undergoes two divisions, producing four genetically different cells from the parent cell. So now that we're going to undergo meiosis one, we're going to follow these two cells, which are now N, representing haploid. So this is my pair of shoes. I'm going to divide my left and right shoe up. Each cell gets a shoe. So in other words, each cell gets one set of chromosomes. So we start this process at puberty. This process continues until the absolute end of life. Sperm can be made throughout a male's lifetime once puberty begins. The process takes between 64 and 72 days. That's on average about 10 weeks to make sperm. Every single day, around 150 million sperm can be produced. Wow, that's a lot of sperm. Wow, that's a lot of people. So, obviously, if those sperm are not making it to thousands of eggs every day, then a lot of them must be dying along the way. In fact, if they're not ejaculated from the testes, the lymphatic system picks them up and kills them. So it sounds kind of evil and awful, but the phagocytes in the testes eat the sperm, the lymphatic system carries them back into the fluid circulation. So an ejaculation may contain somewhere between 250 million sperm and 400 million. So it's just a ton of sperm that are released into a female's reproductive tract. And of course, it only takes one to fertilize the egg. The rest commits suicide. So that's the way it should be, right? Okay, so let's go through and do meiosis one more time. But this time, we're going to reduce that double-stranded chromosome into a single-stranded chromosome. Looks like an 8, but it's actually an airplane propeller. There's a single chromatid on top and a single chromatid on the bottom. So the whole process of making sperm is around 64 to 72 days. That's about 10 weeks' time. Right now, we're about 8 weeks in, so we're 2 months into the process of making these sperm. What we have right now are called spermatids. These spermatids don't look like sperm. They have a round shape. They don't have a tail or a flagellum. They're not ready to swim. So we're going to move them from the testes, from the seminiferous tubules, into the epididymis. They will spend around 20 days in the epididymis undergoing a manscaping effect. So we're going to trim them down. We're going to let them grow a tail. And at the end of those 20 days, that'll finalize our 10-week journey, and then we have full-fledged, ready-to-swim sperm. So we are done undergoing meiosis at this point. All we need to do is turn these into full-fledged sperm. I swear these are not balloons. Okay, they too are haploid, and they have a single-stranded set of chromosomes inside their nuclei. So the story of sperm is kind of cool because they actually grow a helmet that protects their DNA. All you've got in the head of the nucleus here is just condensed regions of DNA. The helmet that surrounds is called an acrosome. So in yellow in this picture, that is the protective helmet around that DNA. That acrosome contains enzymes, and when that helmet hits against the egg's zone or membrane that surrounds it, then it releases all these enzymes that hopefully help to break down that egg's membrane. Lots and lots of sperm commit suicide by literally ramming headfirst against those eggs. And of course, one makes it through and others are prevented from traveling into the egg. So not only are sperm killed by the vaginal fluids, which are very acidic, but also by this process of ramming and breaking down breaking down that egg zone, that membrane around the outside. So, of course, you know, sperm swim. They may have more than one flagellum. When fertilization takes place, the flagellum is broken off and left outside. The only thing that enters inside the egg is the DNA from the head of that sperm. And even though you can't see it here, there's actually a little bit of mitochondria that power behind that head, and that's what allows for this sperm to swim. In a young man, these sperm are very active. They may take 45 minutes to get to the egg. And an older man, I'm thinking Hugh Hefner here, he has kids, right? 2.5 days. That is good timing, right? Yeah, about 72 hours, right? So, yep, they live for around 2 to 3 days. After that time period, they've run out of their fructose sugar supply and they die. So, let me tell you a little bit about females. And I do want to mention there is a little bit on hormones that we just talked about over on page 130. Okay, so you'll want to make sure you read through that. I know that's not something we do in lab. Okay, and then if you flip with me over to the female, we'll do the oogenesis process on page 135. Once again, starting at puberty, we see a release of eggs in a female, but this female carried those eggs since before she was born. Think about this. If you yourself have been pregnant with a child, you're not only carrying your child, you're carrying the eggs for your grandchildren. Wow. So that can influence two generations, not just one generation. So when baby girls are born, they have all the eggs they're ever going to have. So what you do as a pregnant mom not only influences your daughter's life, but you have the opportunity to influence your grandchildren's lives. Yeah, how crazy is that? So at puberty, you know, those females around ages, well, now it's earlier than ever, right?
Six.
Babies come out of the womb. Yes, but that'd be awful. It really is, yeah. So whenever females start nowadays, it does seem to be 8 and 9, 11, 12, 13, 14, even as late as 16 in some cases. So whenever the female starts her menstrual cycle, she has basically a race in her ovaries to mature an oocyte. It takes 2 to 3 months, just like it does with a male, to produce mature sex cells. And when a female ovulates an egg, it's not just an egg, it's a diva. Look at this. She has not only the biggest cell in the human body, there's the nucleus on the inside, but look at the ring of cells that comes with it. These are what we think of as the follicle that surrounds that oocyte. And when those sperm are hitting against that egg with their acrosome helmets, that's what they're breaking down. They're not just trying to penetrate into the egg's membrane. They have to break down her diva ring that goes all the way around that oocyte. So this is what female ovaries look like. They actually burst like blisters, the oocyte from the surface. So you can see here an ovulated oocyte coming off the surface. It's, you know, kind of fascinating to think that a young woman doesn't have a bunch of blisters on her ovaries, but an older woman that's closer to menopause is going to have an ovary that's just all these little, like, war wounds. Yeah, like little cysts have popped off. And so now you really see how it's so important for those fimbriae of the fallopian tube to say, hey, come this way, don't go anywhere else, but come this way. Because if that egg is left out here in the pelvic cavity, it secretes chemicals that say, hey, sperm, here I am, come and get me. So, of course, fertilization can occur outside the uterus, outside the fallopian tube. So it's really important that those fimbriae pull, and the cilia inside pull that egg into the fallopian tube. Okay, so there's a lot of similarities here between spermatogenesis and oogenesis. What I'd like to do is just lay this on the board side by side so you can see the similarities there. Okay. Story with an oogonium. These, of course, are present in a female's ovaries. And before the baby girl is ever born, she's already made not only her oogonia, she's also made her primary spermatocytes. Oops, sorry. You guys are going with it, aren't you? This guy with it, she's tired. Yes, and make those primary oocytes. About 400,000 is what a typical female baby has, is 400,000 primary oocytes. I know that sounds like more than you could ever possibly use, but like I said, there's a race every month, and the winner gets to be the one ovulated. So that's basically how we're looking at this. It's a race. Some of them won't be ovulated. So far we're looking pretty similar. We're going to undergo meiosis one. Meiosis one is going to produce a secondary oocyte. Now notice it is haploid. And then you notice that we make this strange little cell called a polar body. So what is that polar body? It's junk. Yeah. So here's the catch. We need to get rid of a set of chromosomes. And so the female's body takes a set of chromosomes and it puts it in this little package and it says, get rid of this. It's junk. It can't be fertilized. It's not big enough. Because If fertilized, the oocyte has to live for 7 days as it hunts and pecks for a home inside the mother's endometrium lining. So that polar body wouldn't make it for 7 days. It's just a junk packet of chromosomes. It is discarded in a female's vaginal fluid. So, of course, it's not something that can be viable even if it was fertilized. That secondary oocyte is, in fact, what is ovulated each month. Female menstrual cycles vary greatly. If you're a female, you understand that not every month is the same, and the length of time between one period and the next is never the same. Few of us are like clockwork in that we have a routine number of days between cycles. They do say, though, that on average, no matter the length of your cycle, whether you're 28 days, 32 days, 25 days, that most of us will ovulate 14 days into our cycle. So if you start your period on day, some books say zero, some books say day one, 14 days later is when you're going to ovulate this secondary oocyte. So that secondary oocyte has actually begun meiosis II, but it hasn't completed meiosis II. So women have it figured out. They say, I'm not going to bother with this until it's actually needed. And so they send the secondary oocyte into the fallopian tubes. And if it's fertilized, it will finish the job. It will finish meiosis II. So if we're not fertilized in this secondary oocyte here, this is the end of your story. Easy as that, right? Okay, so that would be the end of it. Let's take it the next step and say, what happens if you fertilize that secondary oocyte? So it goes to the fallopian tube, and if in the fallopian tube there are sperm, then we can fertilize that egg. Okay, so only continues the story if sperm are present in the fallopian tube. I'm going to put a little sperm nucleus inside that secondary oocyte. Leave its tail outside. Okay, so here's the problem. Secondary spermatocytes and secondary oocytes are double-stranded. To be a true sex cell, you don't need to be double-stranded. What do you need to be? Single-stranded, right. So until we can strip out a second set of DNA, that second, we got an X shape right now, we want to strip it to a single strand, then we're going to have too much DNA inside this cell. So now that fertilization has taken place, we're going to let this cell develop one more time through meiosis II, let it complete the process. This cell is now called an ovum since fertilization has occurred. And what do we do with that extra set of DNA? Junk. Polar body. Yep. I tried to make the ovum a little bit bigger because it is the largest cell in the human body. You can actually see it barely on the head of a pin. So it's really big compared to the sperm cell. In fact, the sperm cells are the smallest cells in the human body. So only do we call it an ovum if it's been fertilized. I'm going to put that sperm nucleus back in there. Give it a few hours. Let it go through meiosis II. The sperm nucleus and egg nucleus join. And what you end up with is no longer an ovum. It's a zygote. Almost out of room memory. So now that we let the sperm and the egg nucleus join, we're not haploid, we're diploid. So yeah, females are a little more complicated. They don't have exactly the same flow path that a male has, but there's a lot of similarities It's just that there's that stall there at secondary oocyte until fertilization occurs. So if that secondary oocyte is not fertilized, it leaves in a female's vaginal fluids, and of course she never has any idea that it was there. I do want to mention the flow chart on page 138, talk you through that for just a moment. This is a typical female menstrual ovarian cycle, and there are in fact two cycles at play here. The ovaries control the uterus. In fact, once a woman goes through menopause, we can reactivate her uterus with hormones. So even if you've got a woman in her 70s that wants to have her own grandkids, turn on that uterus again with hormones and it will operate. So the ovaries eventually die, they stop producing eggs around the time of menopause. Let's start with the 0 day here on our menstrual cycle. This is right about the time that the menstrual flow begins. It lasts between 3 and 5 days on average here, and we call that the menstrual flow phase. During that part of our cycle, that is when the endometrial lining is sloughed off and bleeding occurs. The ovaries are at the point of starting to mature one of those primary oocytes into a secondary oocyte. Keep in mind, this is about a 2 to 3 month process. So this month's ovulation started 2 to 3 months ago, okay? And then the hormone levels, estrogen, FSH, and LH, they're all very low at this point during the very beginning of the menstrual cycle and ovarian cycle. The proliferative phase occurs after a female's period or menstrual flow. You'll notice the lining of the endometrium starts to thicken. What happens to estrogen during the proliferative phase? Yeah, big increase. This is another one of those positive feedback cycles. So the more estrogen is released, the more we mature the secondary oocyte and back and forth with these hormones, LH and FSH. Notice right before day 14, what happens to LH and FSH?
Spike,
right. So luteinizing hormone is LH, follicle stimulating hormone is FSH. Keep in mind, you know, we called her the diva ring. She had that ring of cells around the oocyte. That is the follicle that follicle-stimulating hormone helps to mature. Luteinizing hormone promotes ovulation. So, yeah, spike them right before day 14, and the very next day, that's when ovulation occurs. Okay? So it is only a day that the secondary oocyte lives. Sperm can live for around 3 days. So if a female has sex 3 days before ovulation, up to about a day or so after, that gives you approximately a 4 to 5 day window during which time sperm can be present and fertilize an egg, okay? So in this picture, you'll notice that after ovulation, we enter what's called the secretory phase. What happens to the lining of the endometrium? Thickens. What does the uterus think might happen? Might be a baby this month. Okay, so the uterus is like grandma. It's always wanting babies, okay? And so it's prepared. It thickens the lining just in case an oocyte might implant. Eventually, after about a day, that oocyte dies, and the follicle dies too, and it becomes yellow. So it's called a corpus luteum for a yellow body, but nonetheless, the death of that oocyte and its follicle, or the ring, the diva ring, that is going to cause the hormone levels, especially FSH and LH, and estrogens to decline. So by day 28 of this cycle, you'll notice the hormone levels have greatly decreased, and at that point, the uterus gets the message that there's no babies this month, and that it's time to slough off and start the cycle anew. I do want to point out that progesterone tends to remain high after the ovulation time period, because progesterone is the pregnancy hormone. To stay pregnant, you have to have high levels of progesterone. So that's why you do see an increase after day 14. And if you're the type of female that has PMS, headaches, bloating, mood swings, you know, just keep going on, right? Notice all those hormones around the day or two before the menstrual cycle begins, they drop massively. So no wonder there's changes in your body because you're seeing a massive drop off in hormone levels. As you go through menopause later in life, these hormone cycles become less potent. the menstrual cycles get closer together. Instead of being maybe 28 days, maybe they're 25 or 24 days, because the signaling mechanism becomes less efficient, and eventually the ovaries stop producing eggs altogether. So menarche is the beginning of a menstrual cycle when a girl is young, say age 10, 12, 14. Menopause, average age is 51, although many women begin much earlier. Some begin later than that. Okay, so I just want to give you an overview that should take you through page 138, and your focus topics are 140. You guys have been great to have this semester. I don't know if I'll get a chance to talk to you on Monday or Wednesday of next week, but I wish you the best if you're going through your program this fall. And if I can ever be any help to you, please let me know. I wish you the absolute best.
Thank you.